Hello and welcome to Take Two. What with it being Monday, but when we're speaking to you, the Prime Minister is still the Prime Minister. But
hang on, just check. Let me just check. Thank you, Simon Poole. Did you tell me you just didn't just Google?
What? I'm trying to welcome people
I know,
to the show.
But Simon Poole just said in my head, Blade Runner, because I'm sitting here wearing a T-shirt with a picture of an origami unicorn on it.
Yeah.
And I just said, you do all know what that is.
There
was a joke
about,
was it a king cover? Yeah, nobody knew. Nobody knew. That's right. Nobody knew.
So welcome to Take Two.
Surrounded by amateurs.
And thank you very much indeed for prescribing and Cindy,
and proscribing.
We prescribe. We're the doctors. We prescribe it and you subscribe. And thank you very much. Just back to Elvis. Martin Coleman.
Yes.
After watching Elvis, it has left me with a sense of disappointment and regret that I hadn't paid more attention to Elvis, the man, over the years.
Right, okay.
But then, slightly undermines his own argument by saying, I've been to Memphis and visited Graceland.
Oh.
And now, so I think you've got a lot of attention.
More than most people have done.
And now admit that I've been blinded by his excesses and preoccupied with the sad, bloated figure that he became and is lodged in my mind, which is actually a reference to some of the other correspondence that we've had.
Right.
I've always appreciated his music and talent, but I don't think that I fully understood Elvis as a phenomenon and performer, which I thought the movie managed to convey in buckets. I thought Austin Butler was amazing, and had me completely believing in and absorbed by his character. I was so caught up with his presence in the film that towards the final scenes, I had to pinch myself a little to determine whether I was watching him or the original footage. The music throughout the film was top-notch. At the peak moments, I was disappointed that people in my modern multiplex cinema audience didn't spring out of their seats and rush to the front to dance and scream. Thanks for your new show, by the way. Up with rock and roll and down with fat, greedy promoters. That's from Martin. Anyway, another Elvis correspondent.
Can I say two things on that? The first one is, you retweeted a tweet by Steve Wright, which you were right, was absolutely class in a jar.
Yeah, no, Steve doesn't tweet, actually, but it was a Radio Moments
tweet,
which was had Steve's announcement that he was leaving.
Absolute.
Radio 2.
Top. Top quality. Secondly,
is that related to the Elvis?
Because you said something that made me think. Love the show, Steve.
Up with rock and roll and down with fat.
No, not that. Before that.
Thanks for your new show, by the way.
Thanks for your new show. And you said it like that. And that's the way that Steve Wright said
it. Slightly
you did. That's the way Steve Wright says show.
Okay.
You did.
In take one, there was someone who said, love the show, Steve.
No, that wasn't it. It was the way you said, sure, which reminded me of Steve Wright. And I was just, it was a very classy thing. Anyway, I forgot what the second part
thing.
Of that was.
No. There was a second thing. It'll
come
remember.
To you.
It'll come to you.
Oh,
take,
I know what it was.
Take four.
I know what it was. When you said, you know, I don't feel I've paid enough attention, but I have been to Graceland. One of the things that I did this week was there's a thing which is a listening party, a tweet along listening party, mm-hmm. in which you play an album and you tweet along to it if you made the album. Well, because the Dodge Brothers did make an album in Sun Studio in 2013, pardon me. And so they play, I hadn't listened to it for quite a long time. So they play the thing, it's Tim's Twitter listening party, and then you as the songs are playing, you tweet along, oh, I remember doing this, I remember doing that, and blah, 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 blah. And it was really bizarre because that's the first time I've listened to it since having watched the Elvis film. And whilst I was in Sun Studio recording that album, I remember feeling overwhelmed by the fact that it was Sun and being very kind of aware of the history and, you know, Elvis and Jerry Lee and everything. But listening to the album after having seen the Baz Luhrmann film, it amped it up even more because I was even more
thrilled
by the idea of the iconic presence of Elvis than I had been before. So, yes, there we go.
And one more on Minions, which is, as we established, the number one here and the number one there.
But they haven't got the fart gun in.
Nick in Edinburgh, Heritage List, the previous correspondent, writing to your new show for the first time whilst listening to Mark's review of the new Minions movie.
Yeah.
My brief take, Rise of Gru only once or twice skirts close to the laugh-out-loud silliness of previous incarnations of the Despicable Me franchise. Each iteration increasingly is more of a cash cow and less laughing hyena. However, it was also the first trip to the cinema with Child 2, who will soon be 4 years old.
Okay.
Child 1, a three-time cinema veteran, was also in tow. At the end of the adverts, as that John Boyega bit comes to a close, a small voice pierced the darkness. Whoa, Dad, this is awesome. said Child 2. Both boys declared Minions 2 to be brilliant, and they're already badgering their film-loving dad to go back to the cinema.
Good.
My heart sings like a Minion doing the Rolling Stones. Keep up the good work and down with the Supreme Court. I'm guessing that he means the American Supreme Court. And the British one,
yeah.
But you know, he might mean both.
Well, we don't have a Supreme Court. It's not called that, is it? It's called the High Court.
It is now called the Supreme Court.
Is it?
Yes.
Since when?
It used to be the House of Lords, and now it's the Supreme Court.
Oh, when did that happen?
I will look it up whilst we're elsewhere, because you have some movies to review, I think. You should have done this last in take one, but you didn't.
So Persuasion, which is new to Netflix. We're recording this show on Wednesday.
Yes.
This show drops, as I believe one says now, at midnight on Thursday. So like, you know, 1 minute into Friday.
Yes.
The Netflix embargo on reviewing Persuasion was Friday, but it's 8 a.m. GMT on Friday, because I believe that's midnight LA time. They must be working it like that.
My top research, by the way, discovers that the Supreme Court was established 1st of October 2009.
Oh, well, there we go. So quite a while ago.
Yeah.
So for the sake of 8 hours...
Ludicrous.
We couldn't review it
but now we can.
The Friday show. Now, I mean, it's Wednesday, so it makes no odds to me anyway, but you're now hearing this on Monday, by which time you've probably seen it and made up your own mind.
And there's probably been three different Chancellors of the Exchequer between then and now.
And
who knows?
The funny thing is, that may not even be funny Monday. So, this is a new adaptation of Austen's final novel, which was written shortly before her death, published, as I used to say, posthumously, because I actually thought...
That sounds good. That sounds like it should be right.
I know.
Like Chihuahua should be the way you
exactly.
pronounce Chihuahua.
Yeah, yeah. Or in Brian and Charles' Honor Loop Loop. But
also good.
Yeah. Anyway, so the tone of the book, which is often thought to be sort of Austen's most sincerely and heartfelt text, is kind of rather different to some of the more upbeat, you know, the Emmas and that sort of thing, which have been adapted for the screen umpteen times. I mean, most recently we had Emma Full Stop, you know, which felt like a very modern adaptation. The story is of a central character in her late 20s, so way past it, who was persuaded to reject a suitor at the age of 19, has pined for him ever since. Now he returns as a successful maritime career. It's obvious that he feels the same, and yet they both avoid saying to each other what they know to be true, and instead become kind of lost in internecine social and romantic struggles until the very end, because a lot of it is to do with, you know, the feeling that the moment has passed, that something, that the opportunity was there and you were persuaded not to take and it's gone. Several TV adaptations. There was a BBC miniseries in 1960, an ITV miniseries in 71, Roger Michell's BBC film from 95, which was released theatrically in the States, 2007 ITV adaptation with Sally Hawkins. Now, new Netflix adaptation with Dakota Johnson, who you've interviewed.
Yes.
Yeah. Cosmo Jarvis, who I think is fabulous. The great Richard E. Mm-hmm. Grant. Henry Golding. And our very own, Ben Baby Smith.
Who apparently is in the building somewhere.
Yeah, he's going to come in. We're going to rope him in. Anyway, so directed by theatre director Carrie Cracknell from a script by Ron Bass and Alice Victoria Winslow. The tone of the new version is in stark contrast to the tone of the book. It's much closer to the archness of Emma Full Stop, as that film will be called. Clearly also made in the wake of the fact that Bridgerton became, I think it was it Netflix's most successful series? I mean, just staggeringly successful.
I mean, presumably Stranger Things is the biggest.
Squid Games, I think, was absolutely enormous. The time that it came, Bridgerton was a huge...
Did they even reveal those figures?
I know that it was revealed that Bridgerton was a huge...
Yes, but, I mean, certainly a big success. Yeah.
So this version includes anachronistic languages like OK and X's and lots of kind of post-Fleabag, cheeky, you know, looking at the camera and nodding at the camera and in fact, monologuing to the camera, as we will hear in this clip from Persuasion.
Meet my sisters-in-law, Henrietta and Louisa Musgrove. They are beautiful in every way.
We said that you'd come.
We've been positively giddy all week. You must promise to spend every waking second with us. No excuses.
When you aren't attending to your sister, of course. Mm. How are you feeling, Mary?
You haven't even asked me how I'm feeling.
I just did.
I'm so close to death, I can feel my organs decomposing.
Same as yesterday, then.
We're encouraging that though her organs rot, her personality remains as fresh as ever.
So, you could tell from that, kind of fairly upbeat,
yes,
breezy tone, and Dakota Johnson talking directly to the camera. When the trailer for this came out, it caused uproar among the Austinites, of whom there are many, who concluded on the basis of 2.5 minutes that this is not Austin. And of course it isn't. I mean, like the personal history of David Copperfield, it has colour-conscious or colour-blind casting, mean that people are cast because they're the best person for the role, you know, and ethnicity has no role to play. Hooray, great. I think this is a very good thing. The breaking the fourth wall stuff, so Dakota Johnson talking to us directly, this is a well-established way of dealing with internal monologues, because an awful lot of the Austin is interior stuff. It's, you know, it's description, it's letters and, you know, description and stuff that... One way of doing that is have the character talk direct to the camera, so I don't have a problem with that. The tone is definitely more breezy and upbeat than the book. I mean, particularly when you've got Richard E. Grant camping it up as the vain father. And, you know, and the sister going full petulant, you know, all my internal organs are decomposing and all that stuff. So there are more obvious laughs. The question is, well, twofold. One, does it work in and of itself? And secondly, does it capture any of the essence of the story? So the story is basically two people who are out of place in the world, who had a moment when they fitted and are then rent asunder by persuasion, by social nicety, let's be honest, by wealth, and who are the only people who really see each other for who they are, but are not able to say it to each other. So I thought Dakota Johnson was good. I mean, she's, you know, she's always good. Cosmo Jarvis, I think he's brilliant. I mean, he was if you look at his performances in this, in Lady Macbeth, Calm with Horses, all terrific performances and all unrecognizable as the same person. He is one of those people who looks different every time you see him. And I think he's just stunningly talented. And I think he gets the awkwardness of that character who has, you know, earned their stripes and their success, but is still fundamentally out of place. I think he does that really well. There are problems. One of the problems is that the change in tone, the making it lighter, makes the inability of the two central characters to simply declare their love for each other much more problematic. Because when it's a kind of a repressed interior monologue, that sense of distance is okay. But when everyone appears to be saying everything out loud all the time, you just want to go, just tell him you love him and just tell her you love him. Just, you know.
That's that saying, don't go and stay in that log cabin in the woods on your own.
Exactly. And here, I think, is the reason that it prompts that response is that because the interiority of the book is made exterior by the film. And as a result of that, the mechanics of the plot, which always seemed just, you know, to be machinations happening in the background in the original source, suddenly come forward because everything is much more front-footed. And so I felt, whilst watching this version of it, that the desire to go, just do it, was much stronger because the tone of the film kind of invited that. And I think that problem is because the interior has been made exterior. And when that's the case, it's like the mechanics are much more on view. They're much more evident. I also think some of the Fleabaggy, you know, nods and winks and, you know, like somebody will say something and Dakota Johnson will look at the camera and do a kind of, you know, a wry. I think that becomes irksome. It's not a cardinal offence, but it's just a little bit annoying. I think if you take it completely on its own terms and don't see it as an Austin adaptation, there's stuff in it that's fun. And it's, you know, it's got a very good cast, all of whom do what they're meant to be doing really well. There's not a duff note in the performances. But I do think that kind of transition in terms of the, you know, let's make it much more accessible. Let's make it very post-Bridgerton, post-Fleabag, post all those things.
Also, House of Cards has that where the central character turns to the...
Yeah, well, it's...
Kevin Spacey did it particularly.
Yeah, right? That is a well-established dramatic device, and I don't actually have any problem with that. I have more of a problem with the kind of the coy nodding and winking. But I think in and of itself, it is a perfectly serviceable piece of entertainment. And I think that the essence of the Austin thing about these two people, neither of whom can be themselves in any company other than each other's company, is still in there. But I can, you know, I can understand why Austinites get annoyed about it. The only thing I would say is, dismissing something on the basis of the trailer is never a very good move, because the trailer definitely plays it as more broadly comedic than perhaps the thing itself is. So, you know, it's kind of fun. It's not, I wouldn't say it's a classic Jane Austen adaptation, but nor do I think it's, oh, how dare they? You know, it's, well, they dared, and, you know, some of it worked and some of it didn't.
Mark Addison.
Yeah.
Dear Walk and Wildside, heritage listener here, just a note that the ubiquitous and brilliant Herbie Flowers,
yes,
not only played bass, tuba actually, on Grandad, he wrote the darn thing.
Oh, did he?
I've been playing bass for 50 years, albeit in a completely different orbit, nay, solar system to Mr. Flowers, and certainly wouldn't have turned my nose up at the paycheck. And I love the new show and production crew. I don't know why you have to praise everybody like that.
So the email got to you, that's why.
So Herbie, that's absolutely right. No, that's a good point. So Herbie Flowers wrote Grandad.
When I was writing How Does It Feel, I had included, because there's a whole sequence in that about...
One of my many best-selling books.
Yes. There's a whole sequence in that about something that happened with me and Rick Wakeman. And I had said completely wrongly that Rick Wakeman played piano on Grandad, because Rick Wakeman does play piano on loads of things.
He was like early 70s stuff.
Yeah, and I sent it to him and said, could you just see all these right? He said, it's all right, but I didn't play piano on Grandad. He said, I didn't do that. I'm not having that one.
On everything else.
Almost entirely everything else, but not that.
SJ says, does anyone else have to fight back tears in the cinema? I'm not talking on a Bambi slaying level of sadness, just being in the cinema. I have to fight back tears at the coming to the cinema trailer section. Sometimes it's almost overwhelming sobs.
Is this since COVID?
Well, for something that doesn't even deserve a sarcastic Lonely Man IMDb review. I have no idea why, but I do have lots of hair standing on end all over the body when listening to music, so not sure if it's the same thing. So this, well, let's throw it out and see what happens. So SJ just has to fight tears. SJ doesn't mention COVID, doesn't mention that it's sort of because I'm back in the cinema, but maybe there are other people who just go to the cinema and start being emotional.
I'll tell you my equivalent of that is, because I spent so much of my childhood in cinemas, and I can remember every cinema that I went to, you know, it was the Hendon Odeon or the Classic or the Gaumont in North Finchley, where we talked about the view in North Finchley earlier on. In every cinema that I went to, I had my preferred seat. Because I don't know whether you did this thing, but I had, you know, slightly obsessive compulsive disorders, you know, like, no, I can tell you're shocked.
No, I know you always like to sit in the same seat. That's true.
Anyway.
Yes.
So I used to have a thing that when I got to the cinema, if somebody was sitting in my seat, I'd almost have to go and, you know, not see the film, get something else. But sitting down in my seat and going and feeling this long before anything happened on screen, just feeling this rush of emotion about being in the cinema. So I do understand that. And I think people have felt that more profoundly since COVID.
That may well be true. Correspondence at kirbynma.com. There's an American philosopher and writer and theologian called Frederick Buechner, who wrote once saying, you should always pay attention if you are surprised by tears. Which I think is interesting. So, but what's interesting, I'm not sure that this counts because you're not surprised because you kind of almost expect it.
Yeah.
But if something happens and it completes you, takes you by surprise and it brings you to tears, then always pay attention because it means something. One other thing from Nick Pettigrew. After your description in Friday's podcast of Mark as the lady in the van due to the semi-permanent residency in the Mayo House.
Although not last night.
Not last night. It struck me that a tall black-clad visitor with stiff posture whom you now cannot get to leave sounds more like the titular character from another film, Babadook. I must say I didn't really have you as the Babadook character, but Nick, thank you.
Can I just say something on the subject of that, you know, surprised by tears thing?
Yes.
I've been in therapy for a bit, and I was trying to explain at one point that there are certain things that have unusual responses. And you know that there is that, and I won't attempt to say it because I won't be able to get through it without bursting into tears. You know there is that parable about at the end of somebody's life and they look back and they see their life as there are two sets of footprints. And they're talking to the Almighty or something.
Right.
And there are two sets of footprints in the beach.
Oh, I know the story.
Okay, so you know how the story goes. And I tried to say this thing to my therapist, and I literally couldn't get to the end of it because it's just something about it. I'm so overwhelmed with tears, I actually can't do that thing. And that thing about, you know, if you're ever surprised by tears, you should pay attention to it. And I've thought an awful lot about why it is that this incredibly cheesy, almost Hallmark greeting card-like description of life, I literally can't repeat it because it just reduces me to a quivering wreck.
It was interesting. Frederick Beatnett, this is a slight discord, probably get edited out, who knows, but it's take two, so I think there's slightly more
leave
liberal.
Leave it in. So he's not even listening. He's talking. They're not listening.
Listening to all the hits on Scala Radio, yeah. I think. Anyway, so here's the thing. Maya Angelou was doing a series of interviews. This is back 10 years ago or so. And I was waiting to do my thing. And she can be quite prickly. And I think this is right. Yeah, so she was doing an interview with Front Row for Radio 4, which didn't go particularly well. And I started the beginning of this particular Maya Angelou book, she references Frederick Buechner.
Okay.
So I start by saying, hey, I noticed you mentioned Frederick Buechner. And from that moment, the interview went like a dream.
Wow.
Because we were talking about other things and she obviously thought, okay, so I'm just giving him some kind of context.
Okay. Is there a book by Frederick Buechner that I should read?
I can't remember what they're called, but anyway, I'll find out.
Okay, fine.
I'll find it in time.
Sounds like it's right up my street.
One Frame Back. This is where we explore films that are connected in some way to one of this week's releases. This week we're recommending robot films inspired by Mark's review of Brian and Charles, although really, from what you were saying about Brian and Charles, it kind of is, but it sort of isn't.
Yeah, but that's like, you know, Jaws isn't a shark film, but we'll still do shark films.
Although it is a shark film, obviously. Andy says, Ex Machina...
Did you see somebody posted a thing? Sorry, it's Monday, but somebody posted a thing out on Twitter of the mayor from Jaws standing outside number 10 saying, the cabinet is open and everyone's having a marvellous time.
That is very good. I wonder who's in the cabinet now, since we recorded this podcast. Ex Machina is probably the robot AI film to beat these days. Still gives me the chills. Thank you, Andy. From the Everything blog, Mitchell's versus the Machines is absolutely wonderful. Lord, Robot and Frank with the legendary Frank. Is it Langella or Langella?
I think it's Langella, but I may well be wrong.
Is an underrated gem, funny, poignant, a film about growing old and a heist movie with a robot. Ian Willis, Westworld, Yul Brynner as the cool bad guy with his cold eyes and black cowboy suit, the best and baddest robot before Terminator. It holds up well to say it's almost 50 years old and came at a time in the early 70s when we were saturated with sci-fi films. So what are we going to do for One Frame Back?
Well, I mean, I understand that obviously definitions of robots and cyborgs and all that blah, blah, blah. You know what we mean. If we say robot, we mean... A sentient being that's mechanical on some level. So I would have also included Lance Henriksen in Alien, for example.
Okay.
Aliens. So Aliens. It's Ian Holm in Alien. I'm surprised that hasn't come up. The thing that I am going for, however, is Silent Running because of Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Because I think that Huey, Dewey, and Louie are absolutely perfect in terms of what it is about robotics on film that works. So they are these three drones that look like little walking waste bins, and they don't talk. Everything they do is to do with physicality, and they have very little physicality because they're just, you know, they're like these squat drones. They're performed by actors walking on their hands rather brilliantly. And everything that you know about them is, on the one hand, it's projected onto them by Bruce Dern's character, by Freeman, but it also is reflected back because of these tiny little physical movements that they make, tiny, tiny gestures that just seem to absolutely embody everything that he wants them to be. He wants them to be companions. He wants them to be friends. He wants them to be, you know, he's anthropomorphizing them. And then, of course, the film ends up with the heartbreaking sight of one of them alone in space with a watering can in the last of the Earth's forests drifting off into the abyss. And I think it's just the perfect film about what a robot can be. I mean, obviously Forbidden Planet has got the classic screen robot, and, you know, if we're going to do TV series Lost in Space, but I think that the drones from Silent Running are just absolutely sublime screen robotry.
Where can I see that? Are you going to say it's widely available?
It is widely available. It is widely available. It is a source of some regret to me that I'm not on the Blu-ray commentary for it, which because they recorded it during lockdown, and I think that Kim Newman ended up doing a commentary for the new Blu-ray. But yeah, just see it however and whenever you can. It's been on television fairly recently, and it's, you know, it's 90 minutes long, and it's pretty near perfect.
Next week, Mark is reviewing McEnroe. So we are looking for your picks for sports documentaries.
Okay.
I think that's the way to do it. correspondence@curbadomeo.com. This week's You Decide has been suggested by many people.
Yes.
This is our kind of word of mouth feature because there's so much media out there. It's very easy to have fantastic things, but you just miss them altogether.
You do.
So this is your opportunity to say, here, have a look at this.
Oi.
So Kate, or possibly Kat, from Mitcham in Surrey. Hello, boys. I'm not going to lie. There is quite a bit of silliness in The Boys, which I have been watching with my son, who suggested it. He's 16, by the way, a point which will seem more important shortly.
Okay.
The premise is superheroes are made via some patented gunk that Vought, V-O-U-G-H-T, the company who markets said superheroes, invented.
Okay.
The boys, who have for various reasons vowed to take down the superheroes, the various reasons being that they have been corrupted or always were, and occasional death and mayhem is shrugged off as being inevitable. What is clever in The Boys is the very clear ways that the superheroes themselves are archetypes that are plainly used in Marvel and DC type comics, given such ludicrous names as Black Noir. The scripts are smart and grown up, and neither the good are wholly good and the bad wholly bad. The funniest thing, though, and Mark will find this endlessly annoying, is how much Carl Urban's disastrous London accent sounds like he's doing an impression of Captain Jack Sparrow, a fact that by season two, the show creators are obviously aware of, given that Urban even starts moving his head in a Sparrow-like fashion. The thing I've left out until now is the cartoonish violence, which is deliberately disgusting, but some may find it a bit much. It's very post-video game in tone, but some viewers may be revolted fairly regularly. Very much liking all the extras. Tinkety-tonk, down with fascist superheroes. That's Kat, who's in Mitcham. And before you talk about it...
Yes.
Stephanie in San Diego.
Oh, yeah, this is a fabulous email, which touches on the subject of Carl Urban's accent.
Yes, you have to catch The Boys on Amazon Prime. It's a subversive political satire of late-stage capitalism. Imagine a world in which superheroes or soups become prized commodities. It's an examination of unchecked power, racism, sexism, totalitarianism, and toxic masculinity, and a direct attack on the former guy and his MAGA followers. The hilarious thing is those people have only just realized that they're the punchline. I don't want to spoil it too much, but the protagonist turns out to be a smart person, a really smart guy, very, very intelligent, very stable genius, you might say. This is all wrapped up in extreme violence, wonderful fight scenes, and a set of terrific performances from, in particular, Jack Quaid as Huey Campbell, a character based on Simon Pegg, and Anthony Starr as the MAGA soup Homelander. A word on Carl Urban, and in particular his accent,
yeah,
which seems to switch from Stepney to Sydney to Wellington, sometimes within the space of a single word. I've got around this obstacle by creating my own backstory for Urban's character, Butcher.
Go on.
He's a Kiwi Cockstralian. Don't like the sound of that. Who spent his childhood between the East End of London, the North Island of New Zealand, and Sydney. In the original comic book, he grew up solely in the East End, but that does not seem likely if you listen to Mr. Urban's wayward accent. It should be noted that Butcher is voiced by none other than Jason Isaacs in the animated series The Boys Presents Diabolical. Anywho, don't let Carl's accidental accent triumvirate put you off. The Boys is one of the best series of the last 10 years. Now that is some kind of recommendation from Stephanie in San Diego.
It really is. So amongst the huge amount of viewing that we had to do for this week, so I have seen the first two episodes of series one of The Boys. I know that we're on, you know, it's three series now, but I'm going in from the beginning. So loosely adapted from a comic book by Garth Ennis and Derek Robinson. Originally intended, apparently, to be a feature film with Adam McKay attached back in 2008. That fell apart, revived by Cinemax in 2016 as a series when Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg came on as producers. Picked up by Amazon in 2017, and then the seasons were 2019, 2020, and then June 2022, with apparently there's a fourth series on the way. As the email said, a world in which superheroes are commonplace and also commodities, they're marketed and sold like celebrities or like sports stars. There is the Seven is this super league, which is led by Anthony Starr's Homelander and run by the Volt Corporation under Elizabeth Shue's Madeline. Great to see Elizabeth Shue fronting this. So in the first episode, Huey, Jack Quaid, loses his girlfriend when she's run down by A-Train, who is a superhero who runs very fast. And he runs through her so fast that she just explodes. He's left standing on the curb, holding her hands and nothing else amidst this kind of very cartoonish morass of blood. He's then approached by Carl Urban's Billy Butcher, who says... He says he's a Fed, but actually he's the leader of the boys who are this organization who is dedicated to taking down the Supes against whom he has a personal grudge, but who all turn out to be fairly abominable people in private. So in the first two episodes, he has his illusions about them shattered and he gets on board with the boys. Meanwhile, there is a new recruit, Starlight, who is inducted into the superhero group and discovers from the inside that they are not as heroic as they look. I really enjoyed the first two episodes. I thought they were fun for a number of reasons. Firstly, I do enjoy the comic book splatter, and I enjoy the kind of what I can, because I had read that email in advance, I can kind of see where the you know political satire of this is going. I don't know if I hadn't heard that email in advance that I would have been quite so attuned to it, certainly not in the first two episodes, because there's a touch of Chronicle about it in terms of that, you know, it's a world in which superhero is just a thing, it's just a matter of fact, so how do we now deal with it and how do we do with that? I thought Carl Urban and his wandering accent was actually really good. I still feel kind of guilty about the fact that I wrongly underestimated the Judge Dredd with Carl Urban in it, and I do look back, you know, people often say, did you ever misjudge a movie? And I think, yes, I think I misjudged that movie more spectacularly than the many other that I have misjudged. I do think he's very good in this role, despite the wandering accent. I think he does a very good job of getting that kind of cynical, gruff, satirical tone right. And on the basis of the first two episodes, they're about an hour long, each one. Also, the nice thing about it is three series seems manageable. You know, it's like I'm currently on whichever series it is of, I'm getting towards the end of the available stuff of Ozark, and that's taken quite a long time, but I love Ozark, absolutely love Ozark. Darlene! Okay, anyway, and I feel that once that's out of the way, I'll go back to The Boys and watch the rest of it because I really enjoyed it. I also need to watch the other three parts of Blackbird.
Yes, yes.
Because of that, I want to know how that pans out. Yeah, it was good fun. Really good fun. A
couple of references to the former guy.
Yeah.
On the program, who of course stands a chance of being a future guy.
No, he doesn't.
So I just wanted to I can mention another podcast. I mean, they'll always take this out if it's deemed inappropriate. The Rest is History is one of the podcasts I listen to the most. It's obviously just discussing history. Tom Holland and Dominic Sandbrook. Anyway, they've just done a three-parter on the American Civil War.
Oh, right.
And they have a special guest who's a professor at Oxford called Adam Smith, who is genius.
Right.
And if you want to know how the American Civil War impacts now and the former guy, then listen to that.
What's the podcast called?
It's called The Rest is History.
Okay.
And it's really, really good. In fact, after that, I then went and listened to Adam Smith's own podcast, which is called Last Best Hope, I think. And I'm spooling off now.
No, go ahead.
He interviews a guy who's written a book called Robert E. Lee and Me. And this guy is white, Texan, military guy, he's a military historian, who has, over the course of his life, come to realize that it was, you know, that if you fly a Confederate flag, you're a racist. It's all about white supremacy. And this guy speaks incredibly. Anyway, Adam Smith is the presenter. The Rest is History podcast and his own podcast. Really good. Just as like that's take five for you.
May I flag up, therefore, Pod Save America?
Yes.
Which has seen me through...
The dark times.
The dark times. And I just think it's brilliant because it's really informed. It knows its history and its politics, and you know the presenters have a history in speech writing for Obama. it's obviously partisan in as much as it's, you know, it's on the
it's
side.
It's not balanced. It's not saying, over to you, Trumpian person.
Yes, it doesn't say, and now let's wonder whether the insurrection was a good thing. It's really been a voice of sanity for me that has seen me through so many things. And the other thing I would say is, listen to Greg Proops. Greg Proops and the Proopcast, Greg's take on American politics is fantastic. I mean, again, you know, obviously Greg's views are, I think, fairly well known, and they're very much in line with mine. But both Greg and Pod Save America have a way of talking about very dark times, but with humor and insight that you come out of it feeling, I know more. And also, it wasn't just like an absolute horror show.
So before we forget, Take It or Leave It, which is where we started talking about The Boys, which is on Amazon Prime.
Yes.
Thank you very much indeed to everyone for recommending it. And if there is something that you are watching and you're really engaged by and you think that we should get involved and be a part of that discussion, that's what this feature is here for. correspondence@cobenandmayo.com. I think we're done. Thank you very much indeed for downloading. Thank you very much for subscribing. Thank you for being a vanguardista. We'll see you next time.